This week on Writers, Inc.
I think one of the things about being a writer that you have to learn is you've got to make yourself take time off. Otherwise, you'll get into this kind of doom spiral where you're like, I should be writing, but I don't feel like writing. And I'm a horrible person because I'm not writing. And it's like, you know what? If you could just go out and have a little fun, when it's time to write, you're going to feel energized and back to it, and your brain is going to work. I mean, you would never run like 20 miles and then say, oh my God, I just ran 20 miles. I need to run another 20 right now. Your brain is the same way. You've got to give it a rest. And the way you give it a rest is, you know, doing something other than writing.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tumlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So I put out a press release. Finally, we've talked about this, I guess, on the show already, but I'm doing a bunch of titles with co-authors. And we officially announced it yesterday. So we had a press release that went out, I think, nationally in the U.S. and Canada, just to kind of kick things off. And, you know, we can finally talk about it. The first book that's actually happening. It's called Heavy Are the Stones, and I wrote it with Christine.
Yeah, it's coming out November 26th.
Yes.
Woo-hoo. And it's a biopic about the Rolling Stones and how they gained so much weight.
It is not about that. But it's up on NetGalley right now if anybody would like to check it out. The initial reviews are good, which is strong. And this whole project has been, you know, I kind of wanted to talk about this because from a business standpoint, you know, I'm kind of in uncharted territory here. You know, in a lot of ways I'm mimicking what Patterson's been doing for years, but you know, he's got Little Brown and Hachette behind him. You know, he's got, you know, he's kind of built it over time, and I'm trying to kind of just create this model on the fly. And like one of the things that I was really running into as far as a brick wall is foreign translations and things like audiobooks. You know, it's one thing if you're an author and you're putting out one or two titles a year, but when you go to those entities and you say, okay, well now I'm going to put out 12 titles a year, are you in? You know, it's not easy to get everybody to agree with that. Recorded Books came on board straight off the bat, and they agreed to do all the audiobooks for all the co-author titles as well as my individual stuff, which is great because I've got a fantastic relationship with Recorded Books. They've done a great job on all my other books, and I'm thrilled that I can work with them moving forward. Foreign publishers have been hit or miss, and I totally get it. You know, if you go to a big publisher, you know, that's a lot of books. You know, some of the foreign publishers that I work with, they don't even put out that many titles, you know, total, you know, so let alone, you know, ask, you know, somebody to translate 12 books and, you know, put them out. And, you know, it's not just translating. I mean, they're basically doing the whole gambit. They're putting out the ebook, the hardcover, the audiobook, the same thing you would see in the States. But we've had a surprising number of foreign publishers that have signed on, you know, straight off the bat, just like Recorded Books did, basically committing to a certain number. We're roughly about 12 with everybody. So two solo titles for me and 10 co-authored titles. So 12 books total for the year. Is kind of what we're shooting for. But I told my agent, you know, like whoever doesn't bite, you know, if we can't get a foreign publisher to do it, I'm going to hire my own translators. So that's what I've been doing. I've basically been filling those holes by hiring my own freelance translators to get the other ones out there. But it's been fun. It's definitely a wild ride. I'm curious to see where it's going to be like a year from now.
Nice.
Yeah, man. That is cool.
Very exciting.
Very cool.
And everyone should download Heavy as the Stones.
Heavy are the Stones.
Heavy are the Stones.
I've been having some heavy stones here this week in Los Angeles visiting. We've had two earthquakes. I'm like, how did I come? We had a 5.1 and a 4.4. And I'm like, just my luck that I would be here during two massive earthquakes. And all the news is like,
I mean, I feel like that's your LA welcome.
That was my LA welcome. I'm just hoping my plane out today is not affected by earthquakes. So everyone think good thoughts for me.
Well, planes are in the air, Christine. So
perfect. Yeah. Well, no, I mean, yes, obviously.
If you're going to experience an earthquake, it's probably better if you're in somebody else's house, right? When it happens, rather than your own house going through an earthquake.
I don't know how that makes it better. I mean, I'm still going through an earthquake at that point. It doesn't matter where I am. Like I'm still very afraid and have soiled pants.
Yeah, I was outside for both of the earthquakes.
One more reason I won't go to California.
All right. Well, we've got a lot of news.
Let's get to the news. Yeah. So first up, Apple requirements are about to hit fans at Patreon. That's a funny headline. Starting in November 2024, Apple is enforcing that Patreon uses its in-app purchasing system for the iOS app, eliminating other billing options. This change subjects new membership purchased in the app to Apple's 30% App Store fee. Patreon's existing first-of-the-month billing model isn't supported by Apple's system, which only allows subscription billing. To comply, Patreon will begin migrating all creators to subscription billing by November 2025. Creators can either increase prices for new iOS memberships to offset the Apple fee or absorb the cost themselves. Patreon offers the option to delay this migration until November 2025, but during the delay, new memberships won't be available in the iOS app. This feels like extortion to me, frankly. Which I know is unheard of from Apple.
Yeah, this is terrible for indie authors.
They've been doing it to everybody, though, right? Like, they squeezed Audible, you know, for the longest time with the same thing. And I'm not quite sure. I mean, I have a Patreon account. I'm terrible at posting stuff to it, so I don't really pay much attention to it. But if you're an author and that's a big portion of your business, I'm not quite sure what direction you go in with that. I don't think you could charge more. That doesn't feel right. All right, so I really think the author is going to end up taking the hit here. They're going to have to eat that percentage.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you still use it on the web, though, you can circumvent that maybe. I wonder. I know with like Kindle Vella, if you read it on the app, you have to pay that fee, but it's cheaper like if you still do it on the web.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering if you don't.
That would be the answer, I think. Yeah. I don't see how Apple can't like enforce a rule, outside their platform. So I would think that's true.
Right.
And I would think that is the answer, is to just encourage all subscribers to go to the URL. And, I do this on Kindle. Like when I want to buy something on the Kindle app, because of Apple, I can't buy it within the Kindle application, but I created a shortcut for the Kindle store that's on my desktop. And clearly they meant for me to do that because they had it come up with its own special little desktop icon. I'd buy everything through that. So it circumvents Apple's gate, which I love to do. All right. Well, next up, a grim fate befalls horror publisher Darklit Press. Indie horror publisher Darklit Press is effectively shut down after founder Andrew Roberts stepped down, leading to authors reclaiming their rights and alleging unpaid royalties. The company's website and social media have gone dark, signaling its troubled state. Caitlin Marco, who took over after Roberts' departure, reported that neither she nor other staff had access to the company's finances, complicating efforts to manage the situation. Despite these challenges, Marco continues to lead, and I'm going to call this Hedon Books. I think that's it. Hedon Books, an imprint originally under Darklit. Authors have been vocal about their frustrations, with many pulling their work from Darklit. Imprints like Trueborn Press and Third Estate Books have severed ties with the company, and Darklit's mismanagement has left a lasting impact on its authors. A cautionary tale.
Yeah, this is sad.
I want to hear from Jenna on this one, because I know she's been down the rabbit hole on this.
Well, I mean, personally, I think Darklit published my second short story, like professional sales. So that's very sad to see everything that's been happening. And I know that there's been a lot of issues with communication, even under the new management. So I think that maybe this is a case of kind of trying to stay above water, and maybe not, I don't know. I think that maybe Caitlin should have just been more upfront earlier, is what I've taken away from a lot of different author statements that have come out. But
Yeah.
I don't know. It's very sad.
The fact that they don't have access to the financials is like one of the biggest red flags I can think of. You know,
yeah.
Was this guy operating it from his own, like, you know, PayPal account or something? I mean, how do you not have access to the whole company's financials?
I don't know. I know that at some point he like did a whole announcement and handed over the company, which seemed fine. But I think some of the problem is that like one of Caitlin's statements said that she never had access. But that was several months ago that she took over. So I think some people are like, well, if you never had access, why weren't you, you know, telling people that and being upfront about that. So there's just, could just be inexperience. You know, she didn't want to burn bridges or throw people under the bus, you know, maybe gave him his word. I'm not exactly sure what happened, where or when, but yeah, if you take over a press, definitely get financial access to the records.
Yeah. And some of these presses, you know, there's not that many people running them, right? I used to, early on in my career, I did a bit of acquisition editing for a small press, and it was literally just the husband and wife. So when the editor-in-chief, who was the husband, got sick, that was the end of the press.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes they're very small.
I mean, a lot of these, I don't know the history. I don't know the history of this particular one, but a lot of these small presses basically came out of, you know, authors that tried to make it on their own as an author, didn't quite work, but they understood the publishing model, you know, as far as how to get books on KDP and Ingram and on Baker and Taylor and all these different segments. So they just said, well, I'll do your books. And, you know, before you know it, they're publishing four or five different people. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, it's a one or two person operation. And that can be sketchy. I always warn people off of small presses, and you know, there's obvious good reasons for running with one every once in a while, but at the same time, you just have to weigh everything. You know, if they're not throwing a big advance at you, if they're not giving you something that you can't do on your own, decide whether or not it's really worth it. And at the very least, make sure your contract has some kind of out. You know, pretty much every contract I sign, you know, it allows the publisher a certain amount of time to get the book published. So they get 12 months, they get 18 months, they get whatever that time frame is that we decide on. But if they don't, then the rights come back to me. And I don't owe anything back. So if an advance was paid, I don't have to pay it back. But at least this way, if somebody goes under, something changes, you know, something happens on the business side, you know, I've got an out and I've got a way to continue. Because you know, ultimately as an author, you have to look out for yourself.
Yeah, I, you know, one of the things I was surprised about the most with all this is that, you know, Dark Lit, they were actually doing like what appeared to be a lot of the right things. Like, I know that at some point they had an agent that signed on to work for TV and film rights. You know, they were publishing like their acquisitions and publishers marketplace and really trying to legitimize themselves. So like I said at the beginning, it's just very sad.
Yeah. Well, final story, Barnes & Noble to limit erotica and summary titles on their site. That summary title one is a long time coming. So glad to see that. But Barnes & Noble is removing certain books from its online catalog, including erotica titles, public domain works, and quote, summary titles. The changes primarily affect self-published and print-on-demand erotica titles, especially those that violate content policies related to explicit and taboo content. Mainstream erotica and spicy romance from well-known authors like Colleen Hoover and Sylvia Day are not affected. Barnes & Noble is also updating its website search functionality, allowing customers to decide whether they want to view explicit content, providing more control over the content they see. The decision to remove these books is partly to reduce customer confusion, especially with summary titles that mimic popular books, and to address legal concerns. The changes will impact a broad range of authors and publishers, including both indie and traditional authors, as well as content aggregators. Ooh, you content aggregators.
Can you explain what a summary title is?
It's a book that there's a popular book out there, J.D. Barker's latest, and somebody writes 10 pages to summarize what the book is about so that you don't have to read the whole novel.
I think it's more popular with nonfiction. I come across this in my day job a lot where they like short form. There's like websites that basically summarize nonfiction books, and these end up getting put on Amazon a lot of times, which I've never understood how it's legal. But it's essentially like a Cliff Notes type of model. So they'll have like the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, and someone will go through and essentially summarize it into the key points and then put it on Amazon, and somehow that was legal. And they also do it with they create workbooks for these nonfiction books too, and then profit off of those. So, which always felt super sketchy.
The real kick in the teeth is that you, for whatever reason, those books end up coming in at the top of search results on Amazon and elsewhere. So someone goes in looking for the, you know, not the latest Steve Covey, since he's been dead for a while now, but, you know, the hottest nonfiction title out there. They're more likely to see 20 or 30 of these summary books before they actually see the title they're looking for. And a lot of times they're very clever in the way they title the book. So they'll make it actually look like it's that book. So people will buy it by mistake a lot.
Yeah. I've even seen it where they steal the cover art. And like the only way you would be able to tell is by like either the author name or the publisher name. It's very hard sometimes to tell. I'm glad they're booting them off. I wish Amazon would do that. I don't understand why they let them do that, but
yeah. It really hits me hard though, because my next novel is going to be called The Summary Book. So I'm really worried that it's going to.
You might have to rethink that.
Oh, yeah. So that is it for the news this week, everybody.
Awesome. JD, who is up this week?
This week we've got Karen Slaughter coming on. Karen's the author of numerous New York Times bestsellers with over 40 million books sold. She's going to tell us all about her latest novel, This Is Why We Lied, which releases August 20th. Here she is, Karen Slaughter.
So you have a new book, This Is Why We Lied, and it's the 12th book in the Will Trent series. And the tagline is, every one of us is a liar, but only one of us is a killer.
It's a great tagline, isn't it?
That is a great tagline. I would love to just start off talking about how you pulled off a locked room mystery when the setting is thousands of acres of wilderness.
Well, technically it's not a room, is it? I love the genre. I love Christie. I read so many Christies, probably all of them, when I was a kid, but I've never written one. And when I started thinking about this new book, I knew that Sarah and Will would be on their honeymoon and that they'd be very happy. And it's difficult to write about happy people, right?
Yes, it is.
And so I knew there was going to be a murder, just because there's always a murder, right? But I started thinking about, and I'll get into the weeds a little on this, considering what your podcast is about. So like, how do you structure that? How do you structure two really happy people and something bad happens, but you have to show them happy, right? Mm-hmm. And so I thought the best way to do this is play with time. So I have the murder happen right out the gate, the beginning of the book, and then the clock resets by several hours and we get Will and Sarah starting their honeymoon and being extremely happy and, you know, sexy and all these things. But also, I was very conscious as a writer that the reader is going to be paying hyper attention to all of these people, because this is a limited cast of characters. So everyone they meet could be the potential bad guy, right? And so I really leaned into that in those opening chapters and introduced basically everybody who possibly could be the murderer.
Yeah. And then you did some nice things with storms and isolation and
that's right.
Nobody can leave. And yeah, it was. So you talked about how you structure it. Do you think about the structure of the novel before you write it, or do you just write it?
No, I always think about structure. And, you know, in the beginning, I didn't. I just was like, oh, I'm going to write a novel and threw myself into it. And, you know, before you're published, you can do 60 rewrites and no one cares. But right. Once you're published, they want that book, right? So you can't play around with things. And I've become much more disciplined in my writing as I've gotten more into my career, because, you know, there's a limited amount of time. And I've also learned the pratfalls of writing a thriller. So, you know, I always tap the weak spots before I write, like, okay, well, what's going to be the thing? Once you're into 100 pages, you know, it's not a short story. So what's going to be the thing that keeps people engaged, and how are you going to structure this in a way that it's interesting? And do you need to kill somebody else? Or, you know, those sorts of questions I've learned to ask early on and figure them out before I start writing, rather than writing into it.
Yeah. And you've been doing this series with Will Trent. This is your 12th book, like we said. So you've been with him a long time. He's got a tragic background. How has you taken him on this journey of healing over the series, where he's now at this point where he can have a very functional marriage? Do you think about things like character arcs over your series, or does it evolve naturally?
I do give quite a bit of thought to that, you know. And I wrote a series of books called the Grant County series before Will Trent, and Sarah was in that. And I knew Sarah would eventually be part of Will's world. And so I spent two books before he even met her, making sure that he was the sort of guy that Sarah would be interested in. And a lot of his change and evolution came through the people in his life, and not necessarily romantic characters, because he was in a horrible relationship with a very abusive woman for most of his life, but through his friendship with Faith, the sort of mentorship that he has with Amanda, his boss, and just kind of figuring out the kind of person he wants to be. And the book is kind of a reflection on that, because you have Will in a place where he meets someone who he knew in his childhood, who had the same kind of experiences Will did for a while in his youth. They were both at the children's home at the same time. And so Will is asking himself, why did I turn out okay and this guy is such a horrible person? You know, what's the difference, and what choices did he make? And just sort of Will worrying a little bit that he could go back to being that kind of person. You know, what is going to keep him anchored being this good husband, a good friend, and a good employee? You know, how is he going to navigate that?
Yeah, that was a really interesting contrast. I'm curious more about, you brought this, not friend, but person that was in the same foster home as him, who's gone down a not great path, and you really see the contrast between the two. Was there anything like real world that you were trying to say with that, or where did that idea come from to contrast with him with basically what is could be the worst version of himself, or where he could have ended up?
Well, you know, I think one thing that we've learned with the pandemic is, because we've all like collectively experienced a horrific trauma, you know, and some of us are like in denial, or we're powering on, or we're not dealing with it. And some of us are dealing with it, and some of us are dwelling on it. And, you know, it's just like this little insight into how people behave when a crime happens, honestly. You could call this a crime against nature, COVID. but I think for Will in particular, you know, his response was to just keep his head down and keep moving forward. And sometimes that worked, and sometimes it caught up with him. And I think that when a bad thing happens, it can amplify some of your worst traits, which we've definitely seen that happen over the last few years. We've just seen some monstrous behavior.
Yeah.
Or it can amplify your goodness. And is there a way to control that? I mean, that's a good question. The whole nature nurture, back to that. Did Will have something in him that was intrinsically geared toward amplifying a better version of himself, and Dave did not? I mean, or the fact that Will had people in his life who cared about him and who looked after him. And, you know, if you think about one thing every child needs is to feel safe, right? So we have, you know, especially in the trauma community, you have a lot of people who will say to victims or survivors, well, it made you strong, right? And it the thing is, it would be so much better to be safe, right?
Right.
To not have to be strong. And so with Will, I think he's come to that realization that being able to depend on other people is not a weakness, it's actually a strength. And Dave has gotten to the opposite end of that.
I think that's just such a wonderful message. You know, when we're writing thrillers, we write them so individualistic, hero's journey. And sometimes it's hard to write someone strong who also can accept help from other people. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Just, you know, my background, I know that one of the most important things for kids to turn out okay who have come from rough situations is to have one cheerleader, mm-hmm. like one person that they're depending on. So I was like, that is so lovely to see in a thriller that he can accept help and they have made him a better person.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's true. And it's funny because a lot of these, I grew up reading a lot of these tough guy, I'll go it on your own. But they always have a sidekick, right? You know, like even Spencer had Hawk, right? Mm-hmm. And you think, well, that's a love story, right? Because they're always there for each other. And, you know, it is true. Like even Jack Reacher, wherever he goes, he develops this circle of friends who are supporting him, like-minded people. And so, you know, and Lee would probably bristle at this, but he is a loner. But he's also someone who is drawn to people who he can respect and who he believes in. And I think that need for connection, it's throughout all of our novels. But because it's men, right, we don't talk about the fact that, yeah, they're getting help because they're these silly jokes they're making with another bro. That's a friendship, right? Yeah. That's emotional. Exactly. That's an emotional framework, right? Even though they're making fart jokes, it's something they share.
Yeah, absolutely. Stronger together. That's the message. And I loved it. So I'm curious, has Will's voice changed as you've written him over these novels?
Not really. You know, one thing is he talks more. And that was very deliberate because in the very beginning of Will in his first book, Triptych, he didn't talk much. And when I thought about the opening to that, the fact that Will Trent in the first Will Trent novel is not the opening character is very deliberate because he's someone who's much more comfortable in background, right? He's not running forth to take credit. He just wants to do his job and help people and then go home to his dog, right?
Yeah.
And so that's very much his personality. And that's why the first time you see him, he's brushing Betty, right? He's just living his life. And the first time you get him from his own point of view, that was all by design. And I've kind of kept to that sort of low key, please don't make me the center of attention, which is also like informed by his childhood, right? Because if you're getting attention, it's usually a really bad thing. If you're an abused child, right? You just kind of blend in. But the thing about Sarah is, and he says this to her, you know, that she sees him. Even when he's blending in, she sees him. And that, to me, it has made him talk more, right? It's not that he didn't. You know, I think a lot of men are like, I don't talk about emotions. And it's like, hey, dude, anger is also an emotion.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. And I think for him, it's not that he didn't want to talk. It's that he didn't have someone he trusted to talk to. And that person is Sarah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm curious, you write different series. And when you think about it, do you write more in the voice of your character, more in your own author voice? Do you blend them? Does it depend on what you're writing? What does that look like for
it's
you?
It's always in the character's voice. And, you know, I don't always agree with what they say. Right? I mean, it's like, Faith is not going to suddenly like this thing because I like that thing, you know? And that was one thing that was fun, and this is why we lie, because Will and Sarah are out in nature, and they're like, oh, it's so beautiful, mountains, and Faith's like, what the hell? There are so many birds. It's hot. They're gnats. I don't want to be here, right? And so I always try to make sure it's the voice of the character. They're staying true to their voice. they're not having some miraculous conversion, right? Where suddenly faith's like, oh, I really love being outdoors now. That to me, that's important. And particularly, and again, because we're talking mostly to writers, you know, one thing I am always conscious of when I write a standalone book is, okay, I need to, once I'm finished, I need to go back and I need to look at this character and make sure the character you meet on page one is believable as the character you finish with. That they haven't, you know, suddenly developed this aspect of their personality. It doesn't ring true. And part of that is because when you start writing a character, you're getting to know them, right?
Right.
And you're putting in a lot of work to build who they are and their world. And then you get further into the book and they're changing a little bit and then they're changing and they change, you know, and then by the end, you know who this is. And the real work of being a writer is going back to that first part and making sure you change that character enough so that it makes sense that they end up at that spot.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because you don't really know what you're doing in the beginning. You're kind of feeling your way out and the reader doesn't need to see that.
Exactly. Nobody does. This is like when you get out of the shower.
Exactly. You know, just like... So, yeah, and you talked a little bit about Faith. Her voice is so great. She really did not like riding that horse. She's kind of like one of those side characters you fall in love with and could almost steal a show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love writing Faith. And sometimes in past books, she's had the kind of front and center. I that's one thing that I like to do when I'm writing a Will Trent book is choose who's telling the story. You know, you get After That Night, it was more Sarah-centric. And, you know, of course, This Is Why We Lied is more Will-centric. But Faith had a great one that I really enjoyed called Fallen, where she's like got a shotgun and she's a badass going and hunting bad guys. But I do think she was really instrumental in this book because you've got a lot of heavy stuff happening. Then Faith shows up and she's like, oh, holy crap. It's a locked room mystery. I'm so excited. But then she has to remind herself, well, actually, Mercy was a real person, right? This is the victim. It's like on the jacket. So it's no mystery that she's the victim of the first, in the first part of the book. And, you know, then Faith's like, wow, she had a kid when she was 15 and I had a kid when I was 15. And she's doing a little bit about what Will did, which is why did I turn out okay? And Mercy was stuck in this horrible relationship. And part of it is that Mercy just didn't have support behind her like Faith did. We all like to think, oh, I did better than everybody because I'm so smart and I'm so clever and I'm this and that. And honestly, it just really boils down to support and having the right people in your corner most of the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now you talked a little bit about the setting and the mountains and the natures. I know that I believe you used to or still do write novels in your cabin. Mm-hmm. Was that inspiration for this setting at all? Is it similar to where you write?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a little nicer than where I write, you know, but we all write fiction. I've been doing this for 20 years. I have a cabin in North Georgia. I go up, I sequester myself. I don't listen to music. You know, I just sit and I write all day and then I watch a little television and then I go to sleep and then I sit and I write all day the next day. And that's something that's worked out well for me. It's not easy because, you know, sitting and staring at a laptop for 18 hours can be a bit tiring. But it's always been the way I do it in these sharp bursts of time. And I usually take a couple of weeks up at the cabin to write. And then I come home and, you know, have to learn how to be a human being again, and reintroduce myself to my cat and my family and get back into that. But that's always been my style of writing. It's just, and part of it was because, you know, I had a job before I became published where I had to show up every day. And so I would get up in the morning at 5 a.m. and start writing. And then I would go to work and then I would come home and I would write. And so I'm really used to those focused amounts of time and just being conscious that this is what I have.
Yeah, that's nice. And so you've set this book sort of somewhere like where you write. And I'm curious, because I know you have said before that you're a bit introverted. Would you enjoy this vacation with all these people you have to have forced breakfast with? And
Yeah, I'm Will. Like when he realizes, oh my God, all those pictures in the brochure, they are with people who are strangers. Yeah, that's totally me. And I'm definitely a, I'm going to eat a banana or something in my room for breakfast so I don't have to go downstairs person.
Yeah.
But Will, you know, for Sarah's sake, is trying to be more outgoing and actually talk to people and pretend to be interested in their experience. And it's difficult for him, but it's something he's willing to do for Sarah. But I definitely am introverted. I would much rather just be in my room reading a book than be out there doing any other stuff.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. I was like, oh no, forced breakfast conversation with strangers and you're on my activities. Like, get out of here. So I'm curious, doing this for 20 years as an introvert, how do you deal with things like doing media, doing conferences? Does any of that get to you?
Well, I love Zoom. I'll say that. It's like the introvert's gift, right? It does, and so we should separate introversion from shyness, right? Because there are people who are really just stymied by being shy. And introversion is just like, I'm very much a loner, and so I know I'm gonna like need to not talk for the rest of the night after doing a whole day of press, or when I'm on my tour, I know, okay, well, you could go out and go to dinner and be around people, or you can eat in your room and reset, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm always going to prefer to do. But I will say, when I first got published many years ago, I met my favorite author of all time at a writer's conference. And I didn't realize until later that she's incredibly introverted, right? Mm-hmm. And so I just went nuts. I'm like, oh my God, you know, it's like, and then on page 3 of chapter 6, you know, whatever, just drilling down into her work. And she looked at me like I was insane. And then she like made an excuse and just walked away. And I was like, oh my God, she hates me. And I thought, you know, people always mistake introversion or shyness for being rude.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to ever be in a position where anybody feels that way about me. So I need to change my affect when I meet people and try to be generous, because honestly, as a writer, they make my life possible.
Yeah.
And, you know, I need to respect that and kind of come out of myself a little bit. I'm lucky I can do it. You know, some people just aren't able to do that. But that was really a learning experience for me, because I felt horrible. And later I got to know her and she was like, oh, I'm so sorry. I just never know what to say when people do that. And I was like, you know what? You should learn to say something.
Yeah.
Because I really felt horrible and I love your books. And she was like, yeah, you're probably right. She didn't learn it. But so I thought I would do better.
Yeah, I love that, because I was thinking about that. I saw you have a tour coming up and it's just packed, like day after day after day of socializing. And I like people as an introvert. It's just, you know, my battery gets drained so fast that if I don't have like my own room and my own space, I just like can't function. So yeah, do you want to talk a little bit about your upcoming tour now that we're on it and where you're going?
I'm really excited. I'm going to some places I haven't been to in a while. And, you know, I'm going to Little Rock. I'm going to Raleigh, which I love the Raleigh area. I'm going to some places I've been to many times, like Chicago, Poison Pen in Arizona, Rhode Island. I haven't been to Rhode Island in forever. As an author, I've been to every single state but for Alaska. So that's like the one state I've never, and like sometimes I'll be in, you know, Wyoming and I'll just get in a car and go to Montana just to say I could do it, right?
Right.
So every state. And so it's nice to be able to go back to some of these places I've been to. But yeah, it's going to be sitting in airports and trying to get my little cocoon to reset. I've got my coping mechanisms and my little snacks and things that I like to keep things familiar.
Snacks are the best. Can you write like when you're on these tours
no,
or you have to take
no.
a break? Just
you
in the
know,
cabin.
I used to feel guilty about it, but I think one of the things about being a writer that you have to learn is you've got to make yourself take time off.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you'll get into this kind of doom spiral where you're like, I should be writing, but I don't feel like writing. And I'm a horrible person because I'm not writing. And it's like, you know what? If you could just go out and have a little fun, when it's time to write, you're going to feel energized and back to it, and your brain is going to work. I mean, you would never run like 20 miles and then say, oh my God, I just ran 20 miles. I need to run another 20 right now.
Yeah.
Your brain is the same way. You've got to give it a rest. And the way you give it a rest is, you know, doing something other than writing.
Yeah, absolutely. Prevents burnout, right? Because we can get there. That's for sure.
Okay.
Yeah. So in addition to your tour, I've also heard that there is a third TV season of Will Trent in the works.
Yes.
Yeah. How involved are you with that process? Do you get involved with it or you just...
I'm as involved as I want to be.
Yeah.
And that is at the pleasure of the showrunner, Dan Thompson, who's a wonderful man. Liz Heldens, who's the executive producer. The cast is very warm and inviting, and they always include me. And so I feel really grateful for that. And they use me as a resource for the books, too, so which is really nice. You know, I'll be on the treadmill, and I'll be like, what was Amanda's mother's name? And I'm like, okay, I know I said it in this book. Let me check. You know, give him the name. So it's really nice to the way they try to include me and make sure they get things right. I mean, I know the cast doesn't look how I describe them in the book, but they're so great at capturing the essence of the character, particularly Ramon Rodriguez, who is just an amazingly beautiful man. I mean, he's super sexy. Let's just get that out of the way. But he's also very sweet and he's attentive and he knows the books and he wants to do the version of Will Trent that everybody loves. And I think that he's been doing a great job.
Yeah. Excellent. All right. We are running out of time. So I just want to ask you one last question. Do you have a favorite piece of advice that either you received or have learned through your career that you would offer other authors?
Well, for other authors who are published, I will pass down the great wisdom that went from Tess Gerritsen to me, which is always pack more underwear than you need on your tour. And that has served me so well in all my touring. She was so right about that. So just wonderful advice. The advice I give people who are just starting out, though, is to keep reading. Because when you are at the beginning of your career, you'll read some books that are like number one New York Times bestsellers. And you're like, what is this shit? How did this person get published? How am I writing the books I write that are so much better? And I'm not number one. Figure it out. Like, what part of that story is interesting to people? And if it's not interesting to you, you've learned something, right? And if you figure out, like, if you read a book and you're like, oh, it's so good, except for this one part, don't do that one part in your own writing. Because it's really easy to say, this is shit. It's so easy. But to figure out why you don't like it, that's the work of being a writer. And to not make those mistakes in your own writing is the work of being a professional writer.
All right. This book was interesting from a craft perspective because she did a locked room mystery in the wilderness. So yeah. I'm curious, like, what is the most outlandish setting you've done or you could think of to do a, quote, locked room mystery? What would you try?
I set an entire series in a Chuck E. Cheese basement in New Jersey.
Did you really?
No, but I will.
That needs to happen.
Man, I was going to hit that buy button like right now.
I feel like all my best ideas come out of this show. I need to start keeping track.
I've never said everything like that. Where I'm coming close though is I wrote a caller's game, which is basically somebody phones into a live radio show and confesses to murder and then continues to kill people live on the air. And in the book, I blow up like half of New York. So we're in the studio, we're out of the studio. I literally destroy like every landmark you can possibly think of. But when, we're in the process of trying to get a screenplay together and Ridley Scott's company is working on it and they asked me to write the screenplay. So I first wrote one that basically follows the book. And it's very expensive. It's probably $100 to $200 million to actually film it along those lines. So now I'm wrapping up a second version of that same one where the entire story takes place inside the radio station studio. So all that external stuff is all coming to them, through outside sources, but we never actually leave that room. And that's been fun. And it's also been tricky. It's almost like writing a play, I guess, because everything has to take place in one place, but still communicate everything, that happens. So that's the closest to that I've ever done.
That's the perfect book. When you do the audio for that one, have it done as a radio drama. That's the perfect one for that.
Well, the audio book that's out now is a lot of fun to listen to just because of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fun. I don't know. I can't think of anything. All I can think about is the Chuck E. Cheese basement. So
yeah, that one's mine.
Yeah,
hands off.
I know you won. All right.
I don't. Yeah. I genuinely people joke. I have readers who make jokes because almost every one of my archaeological thrillers ends up in some form of cave or tunnel. And that may be Freudian. I don't know. But the reality is, like, how do you tell an archaeological thriller story without it taking place underground at some point? Like, that's kind of the point. But it's become a running joke.
Well, we can analyze that after, Kevin. You can just come on. We'll set up a session. I'll call you. We'll schedule a meeting.
Do I have to wear the electrodes on my head again?
I do think that every archaeology-focused book I've ever read has some sort of underground claustrophobic scene. I think that they're almost like mandatory. Like it's one of those expected scenes.
Yeah, that's one of the tropes.
Karen did something else really cool with this book that I liked a lot. So she basically opens it with the murder. But then the next chapter is like 10 hours before the murder and then 9 hours before the murder. And then she kind of backtracks, which is great from a pacing standpoint because it just really ropes you in at the get-go. And then you get to know all the players and stuff involved.
Yeah, that
that really jumped out at me. I mean, Karen's books from a craft standpoint.
It's that ticking clock thing too.
Yeah.
It's like you're
perfectly executed.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, when we're thinking about the structure, she said, tap the weak spots before you start. So you can really see that in her structure that she really thought about it. She outlined it and she said, okay, where's the weak spot? And then started with that murder. I can just see kind of all the planning that must have went into that ahead of time before she put down, word one. But yeah. Amazing.
So unfortunately, my weak spot is my writing. So then it would just all fall apart. And I have to say, I've been wanting to say this ever since we announced that she was going to be the guest. It's like, I feel like I got really screwed on my name as far as like having the perfect author name. Is that a pen name? I haven't even looked into it.
I didn't ask, but it has to be.
I honestly don't think it is.
I knew a guy named Slaughter whose last name was Slaughter in high school. So it could be her name.
I used to know a guy named Mark Slaughter who had a band named Slaughter. So it's out there. But he leaned in.
Yeah, he
leaned in for sure. But as far as I know, that's her real name.
That's cool. The other thing, this was the 12th book in her series. So she had this, character who had a very traumatic history and now has gotten him to a place where he is in a happy relationship. The relationship throughout the book is completely happy. There's no like fighting. I was like, I don't know if I could do that. Could I write a lead who is in a perfectly happy relationship? What do you think about that?
I thought it was interesting that she saw that as, well, now I have to deal with this problem. My characters are happy. I have to figure out how to deal with that.
Well, it is sort of a problem. I mean, like when you write a book, right? Like, I mean, one of the things is, like, no matter what's going on in the character's life, like, everything sort of has to go wrong at various points in the book. And I don't know if it's like an easy way, but, you know, a relationship is certainly one way to do that. And I think tends to be one of the more relatable ways to do that with readers, certainly. Because, yeah. I mean, who hasn't fought with their spouse or partner or best friend? So
I am not falling for that trick. I'm not answering that question.
So I don't know. I actually kind of agree with her. I was thinking about it, like, man, like, where the relationship is solid, but everything else outside of it, that would be tricky, I think.
Well, Karen is extremely good at playing the long game. And if you think about this, this is the 12th book for Will Trent. He's married a woman from Karen's first series, you know, so she carried that over. You know, he had this horrible childhood, a horrible upbringing, but managed to pull himself up as a character, which, you know, gives him a great, you know, story arc. Now he's happy. That doesn't necessarily mean he's going to stay that way. Knowing Karen, you know, she is going to pull that rug out from under him. She's not going to leave him in a happy place. So I wouldn't be surprised if something happened to Sarah, or, you know, something twisted happens to him, or whatever. But yeah, no, nobody stays happy for long. And again, she's playing the long game. You know, it's very similar to the way, you know, I mentioned the structure of this particular book. Like, in a lesser writer, they would have written that in a linear fashion. You know, we would have spent, you know, 200 pages at this particular camp before the murder happened, getting to know all these characters. And it's the exact same scenes. You know, she just took them and shuffled them around a little bit and put them in an order that makes the most sense.
Yeah. And, you know, I actually thought it was refreshing to have a happy couple with, you know, no toxicity between them. But she did a very nice job using a mirror character of Will. So she took a character who was the worst version of her hero and put them against each other, which created a lot of conflict. Is that something that you, I would imagine every one of us probably uses a mirror character or characters who show what their hero could have been down a different path.
Yeah, I try to do that with the quote unquote villains of my books. Cause I think it's just fun that way.
Yeah,
you know, like, to sort of like see, especially when it's subtle and, you know, sort of just like the worst part of yourself versus like the best part of yourself. And there's a lot of fun to play with the struggle of wanting to go down certain paths, and do you or don't you? And
yeah,
I enjoy that.
I've done that a lot, actually, particularly in the Kotler books, because I say a lot. I've done it like two times, possibly three times with that character, because it was much more interesting to sort of present the anti-Kotler, you know. The most recent one, there's this guy named Coben who is in all ways the same character as Kotler, but his motives for everything are much darker and very different. You know, he loses his wife and his daughter, and that sets him on like a course of revenge. I explore that a lot. I actually got criticized for getting too much into the psychology of it in the first book where I introduced that guy. But I loved that concept so much that I couldn't leave it alone. So carried that over for like two or three books.
I think it's also like an interesting thing because, you know, no one like crawls under your skin as much as someone who reminds you of yourself, particularly when they remind you of like the parts that maybe you don't want to acknowledge. So I don't know. I think that also gives a lot of interesting dimension to both the hero and the villain playing with that dynamic.
That's why I have such a problem with Ryan Reynolds.
Yes.
We share abs and similarity.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. So. Abs. Yes. All right. So one of the things I've been thinking about, and I asked Karen this because I've just been thinking a lot about it on my own, is do authors tend to write more in the main character's voice, their own voice, or a blend? And I'd love to hear what you think you do and if it's different for different books.
That is my voice on the page. Yeah, when I'm writing, it's all my voice. I mean, yeah, when I shift to the character's POV, you're going to get a different accent, but it's still my voice. Then I feel like that's what the reader is responding to. So that's my personal take.
There's different levels of that though. So like for me, like she has a broken thing where her heart should be. Like that's written from the, you know, the main character's point of view through the whole book. And to me that's the closest to my inner dialogue, my inner voice, you know, on paper. It's me almost telling a, you know, a fictitious biographical type story. But like when I write, you know, let's say, you know, something with Patterson, like I basically dial it back and I strip out a lot of those parts that make it that, you know, that unique voice, and kind of come up with a more generic voice. But it's, yeah, I mean, it's all obviously our voices. But I think there's definitely different levels of it.
Yeah. I that's a tricky question. I know. Cause I think I tend to have a voice for the character that I definitely hear as I'm building the book. But certain elements of like how I write, which I'm sure would come down to like author voice, are probably pretty consistent, even though maybe the details are different. I don't know, Christine, you've read two of my books so far. You tell me.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you definitely have a voice. There's a lot of snark in your voice.
What?
So, yeah. Yeah, yeah. But no, definitely get into character voice too. I think, you know, I think a lot of authors blend their own voice with the character voice. I think that's what I do, as I've been thinking about it. It's my voice, but the voice is modified depending on the character in the book, I think.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
I would agree with that. I mean, I think because you want it to be where like a reader would like connect. If they like you as a writer, they're going to like certain things that you do. And you want that to be consistent from book to book, even if the books are wildly different, you know, in terms of maybe where they're set or who the characters are. So I think that you would almost have to have a blend.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. Maybe I'll ask more authors about that as they come on and see what they say. Always interesting to me when big authors are introverts and they have to do all kinds of media and conferences. So introverts among us, I don't know who that is.
I think that's all of us, right?
Do you push yourself to socialize at conferences? Yeah. Do you push yourself? Like, do you make yourself go to those dinners or can you be like, I need a break and hide in your room?
I am a high functioning introvert. I can go. Actually, someone told me once that there's a third option that you can be kind of a blend of the two or something. I forget what they called it, an omnivert or something like that.
Ambivert.
That sounds about right. But yeah, I definitely have to be alone and recharge. But when I go to conferences, like, everyone has pointed this out to me. Like, I'm on from the minute I get there to the minute I get back to my hotel room. Like, you know, I'm engaged. We're joking. We're doing stuff. I love being on the stage. I love, you know, talking to the crowd. And I can be kind of a mic whore. And so, you know, I'm all those things. But then at the end of the evening, like when I go back to my room, I'm done. Like, that's it. Everyone else is out at the bar or whatever. And I am, you know, reading a book or watching Netflix or writing usually. And that's it.
Here's the trick I've learned. Get adopted by an extrovert. That is the best of all the worlds. Because they will take you around.
Accept your terms.
And I'm not an extrovert. I am definitely an introvert, but I find that I tend to be adopted by extroverts usually pretty quickly. And I'm not exactly sure why, but I just kind of get picked up and they're like, you're with me now. But it's fine because they end up taking the brunt of all the social aspects of it. You know, they do a lot of the talking and all I kind of have to do is just sort of like hover nearby and I get all of the social benefits. And then, you know, at a certain point I can be like, all right, I'm tired. And then they'll be like, no, don't. And then you're like, no, I'm tired. And then you go. And then, and then you feel like you got to experience the best of all the worlds. That's my advice.
I feel a lot like Christine had mentioned this during the interview, and Kevin, you just brought it up again. Like there's a battery there. You know, like I can walk out the hotel room, I can walk into the big conference room, and I can socialize with everybody, and I can kind of flip that switch and turn it on for those couple of hours. But then I have to crash and I have to recharge and kind of get myself back to normal again. Conferences in particular could be extremely grueling just because of that. You know, you might be a full day or sometimes, you know, more than a day where you're just constantly on dialed up to 11. And then you just want to take a break. But I spend a lot of time, you know, like I know Karen pretty well. I've met Lee Child quite a bit, you know, working with ITW, and certain people are just very good at doing this. And she's a fantastic example of it. Like I've got no idea what's actually going on in her head, but I can tell you that when she walks into the you know, like the cocktail reception at ITW, you know, she's extremely recognizable. So everybody flocks over and wants to say something to her. She takes the time to speak to absolutely everybody that wants to, and she makes everybody that she talks to walk away, you know, feeling good about the conversation. You know, she gives everybody something memorable to take away. You know, that is an insane skill set to have and to hone. And, you know, she kind of hinted at it a little bit. I mean, she has perfected it over time. It's not, you know, I think certain people are born with it to an extent, but you have to tweak it. You know, from a celebrity standpoint, you know, like Tom Cruise always jumps into my head because he's, you know, 60 some years old. He's been doing this forever. But he has that particular persona. You know, you see him on an interview, you see him talking to anybody, whatever. He tends to, you know, make whoever he's speaking to feel like they're the most important person in the room rather than himself, which I think is really important. And Kevin, you just brought up Ryan Reynolds. He's the same thing. You know, you see him in anything. He makes everybody else feel like they're more important than he is. And I think that's a big part of it. But, you know, I've never heard of anybody walking away from a conversation with somebody like that and feeling let down.
Challenge accepted.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I think when people do talk to a celebrity, a quote unquote celebrity, you know, in a way, they're almost looking for not necessarily a reason to be let down, but they're expecting it. You know, and
they're cautious.
You know, so like to be able to live up to that expectation with everybody you talk to, that's not an easy thing to do. And she does it well.
Yeah.
And like she said, she had that one experience and she's like, I never want anyone to feel that way talking to me. And yeah, I mean, I know it's hard for introverts. Sometimes you don't know what to say and you're awkward, but that really struck. Like if someone is taking the time to say they love your work, you can't just be like, okay, and shut down and walk away, right?
I loved hearing that from her too, because that is one of the things that's kind of dinged me over the years is like I'll finally meet somebody that I've admired for a while, and then the, you know, the reaction I get from them is like I don't exist, you know. And after years of pouring my attention into them, to not even get, you know, 30 seconds of granted, these people are approached all the time. You know, I've learned to kind of be forgiving about this, but there is something to be said for, like, I have readers who will email me, and when I email them back, they are beside themselves with gratitude because they'll literally say, I just never expected you to reply. And so it is so much more meaningful when you can take that 30 seconds to say something. So I'm glad to hear she's like that. I don't blame people who aren't like that though. Not anymore.
You know, frankly, when you do reply to that email, that person goes out and they tell, you know, 20, 30, 50 other people about it. You know, it's like, it's worth taking the time, and doing that.
Can I just say, by the way, I want a novel writing cabin. I want the same.
Don't we all, Kevin? Don't we all?
So I'm starting to kind of fall in love with this idea of like, maybe JD's broken me because now I'm doing outlining stuff. And I'm thinking, instead of me killing myself trying to write the book all year or the books all year, I'll just write a bunch of outlines all year. And then like, you know, 2 weeks at a time, I'll go up and spend two intensive weeks in my novel writing cabin and knock the book out. You know, that seems much more efficient to me.
The thing is, she does it and then she comes out with a number one New York Times bestseller. I feel like you would come out of that cabin and you would be the Unabomber. Like, I don't think it would.
Don't insult me. That there is some truth to that worry. So
it's good to dream. Right. Good to dream.
We believe in you, Kevin. All right, JD, who is up next week?
Next week, we've got SB Caves coming on. SB is the international best-selling author of A Killer Came Knocking, and I Know Where She Is. His latest novel is called Honeycomb. It's been described as Big Brother meets Black Mirror, so I'm really looking forward to that one. SB Caves.
It's going to be great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.